Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
Culture.
Competition.
Architecture.
The dirt.
Drinking.
Eating.
Reading.
Thinking.
God, I love the dirt.
Let's not waste any more time.
Let's go straight to the pod.
Thank you all for being here.
We greatly appreciate the support.
Welcome to the Tie Podcast.
As I've said a couple times, you know, go try and be me and play my best golf, and with the knowledge that, hey, if you don't, it's okay. It's still pretty darn cool. Got it. So, hard golf course. Really hard.
Yes.
Right?
Hard golf. Really, really, really tough.
Really, really tough. It goes back to the relationships and people you've had the chance to meet. Had it not been for golf, you know, it's pretty lucky.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for once again joining us at the Tie Podcast. My name is Henry Shimp, and today I am joined for the second time by Stu Hagestad. Stu had a pretty unbelievable September, winning the U.S. Mid-Amateur, being on a victorious U.S. Walker Cup team for the fourth time, and winning the Crump Cup at Pine Valley. We talked a lot about the Walker Cup, about the Mid-Amateur, used that as a natural platform to talk about what he'll have coming up in 2024 with his third Masters and fifth U.S. Open starts ahead of him, and along the way got pretty deep into the weeds on his competitive mindset, what it takes to show up and perform at each of these events, how he thinks about performing in majors versus USGA events, where he's at in his career arc as a mid-amateur, and a lot more. I really enjoy speaking with Stu. He's an incredibly thoughtful guy, and I think you all will enjoy listening to this as well. So without further delay, let's get straight to the episode with Stu Hagestad. I find the hardest part of starting any podcast is literally like just getting into it, like deciding what the first 25 words you're going to say are. So today I'm going with this weird, just like stream of consciousness. Stu, appreciate you joining me, taking some time on a Monday, looking forward to catching up. How's everything going?
Yeah. You too, man. Good to talk to you. Always love hearing from you. You're always one of the guys that I love playing practice rounds with whenever we would happen to show up at the same USGA event. So, it's good to be with you.
Yeah. Appreciate that. Yeah. We'll have a few more of those down the road. It'll be a good time. You know, I was going to finish with this question. I'm going to completely flip the script here. You know, it's like the writing a paper and do the conclusion and the intro and then flip the two. So literally was going to be the last question of the day. Is there a path in your eyes to you playing in 100 USGA championships? I was running the numbers in my head this morning. I was literally sitting in the sauna thinking about this. There's a clear hinge point to it all, but I'm curious to hear just like straight off the dome what your take is.
Yeah, I think that's going to come down to hopefully no more than one person, being my significant other, whenever that ends up happening. And then obviously, you know, probably some kids one day, again, whenever that ends up happening. But we'll see. I think, I forget who it was. I want to say maybe it was Martha Lang that had played in like 99 USGA events. We sat next to each other at an amateur dinner. I want to say at National and the US Open was at Shimmy. I think McCoy is at like 68 or 69. There's a handful of folks that have played in a whole bunch. I'm sure Vinny Giles has a bunch. I mean, that'd be really cool, right? I mean, that'd be wild like to think about, but I don't know what my number is now. I think I'm in like the low 30s, but yeah, that's what a wild concept. I don't know. I think senior, you can really start to accelerate that, you know, if you have a nice kind of start to your senior amateur golf career. Let's think about it, right? Like the most you could play until you're 55 would be, or I guess until you're 50, right? Because you can qualify for the senior open as a 50-year-old.
I forgot about the senior open. That's actually a big kicker here.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could do US AM, US Mid, US Open, right? I count Walker Cups. USGA doesn't, but I do.
In any capacity.
100%, right? Like if you get one of the, so here, if you get one of these, I have one with me. If you get one of these.
Yes.
We're counting.
Hey, look, let's do it both.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Got the medal right here as well. Yeah. They stay close. It's important.
100%. I have them at home. Like I've treated my dad's house like a storage area, which I think for a lot of people that aren't like golf nerds, like the two of us, like would just be like, this is chaos. You're hoarders. This is a problem. Please address this. But
this question's taken on new life. And not only would it be cool to have 100 USGA championships under your belt, but literally 100 on your belt, being able to have 100 of the badges. Yeah. That would be a really cool thing. The senior open, that's interesting. What I kind of came up with is, so yeah, I was running off the number like low 30s. Let's call it five like flex events, right? So like Walker Cups, US Opens, the ones that Eisenhower, the things that you're not like planning out year over year necessarily, but let's say it's like five or six or seven more of those. Then all of a sudden we're kind of looking for like low 60s, 65, you know, probably reasonable to say 15, 20, 25 mid-AMs, and then maybe kind of the south end of that range on the USAM. So then if it's like 10, 12, 15 senior AMs, you're still looking for like another 20-ish events in there. And so my thing was that the four ball, you'd have to decide to start playing a bunch of four balls. But the senior open, that's an interesting one. That kind of gives the thing life.
It's too bad that you can't stack exemptions, you know, you know what I mean? So, the four ball is an interesting one. I don't know. Let's just keep trying to play great in USGA events.
Not an important question. What's more important is the dirt, drinking, eating, reading, thinking. This is your second time on the pod, but the first time we were not doing dirt all the way across the board. So
have I been on your podcast before?
It was a little while back, but yeah, this is number two.
Okay. What am I right now? I'm drinking protein post workout. I feel like when you live in New York City, coffee becomes like a very steady part of your diet. I alternate between almond milk and oat milk. I should be drinking more water, but I don't as much. I also should be eating like more protein. You know, have you ever had like one of those body scans? Like I think we all like undervalue how much protein we could and should be eating. So that's that. But yeah, I've lost a little bit of weight. We've had a fun but stressful September. So we gotta get some weight back on. So there'll be a lot of carbs and hopefully a lot of food kind of going into the holiday season, so to speak. What are we thinking? Just kind of a lot on my mind. Just a couple weddings in October, you know, balancing that with what I have to do on the home front, just regarding work stuff and moving down to Florida here for what work wants me to do. That got pushed back from September.
What else? Unfortunate going into New York winter, moving down to Florida.
I don't mind the winter as much as I should. Right. There's like, I don't know. I was in Chicago for the winter this past winter. So the tail end of 22 into early 23, because that's where they wanted me. And it wasn't that bad. I mean, it was a pretty mild winter, but like the difference between high single digits and like -5 is instead of getting cold in 6 minutes, you get cold in 2.5. I also just didn't spend time outside.
Yeah, understood. I'm in Austin where, you know, it's October 2nd and it was still like 99 today. So not moving towards the cool weather just yet. But anything reading? We skipped over that one. Anything you've been reading?
Yeah, I should read more. I do a lot of podcasts. I do a lot of audiobooks. That is absolutely the part of this question that I need to improve upon. I think I read a lot of things that I don't consider of substance, right? You read a lot of like news that's pumped out, you know, kind of on our daily digest within just internally that we have. Just obviously what's going on in the affairs of the world or like what's prevalent to whatever you're working on. And then obviously like reading the cesspit that is Twitter that I think we can all agree on, but I need to do a better job of that. When I like listen to audiobooks, I consider that reading, and that's a toxic trait of mine. So I need to stop doing that. I'd love to hear your thoughts as a educated Stanford grad.
So, yeah, fight on, I guess. I guess what I would say to that is I definitely am a reader. Like I like a physical book, and I hear a lot of people say that like, oh, well, I've been listening to, and I like, if you're going to listen to something, that's way better than like not listening to something. But I guess the only thing I'll really say is I highly respect the self-awareness that it's probably not a great habit to get into, because you can quickly say like, oh, well, I'm listening to things and like never pick a book up again. You know, I think that there should be a good respect for
having a physical book, you know, maybe taking a note or two here and there, et cetera.
So I'm going to piggyback off of this. What I do, because most of the reading when it gets done is on airplanes. When I'm on airplanes, I am a big movie person, like very specific to movies, but I really make a conscious effort to stay away from like turn your brain off movies. I try and watch movies. I'm like, honestly, like a little bit of a psycho. Like I, like one of my favorite movies is Silence of the Lambs. I'm probably going to get just crushed on this for that, but like,
It's a great movie.
It's one of the three movies.
Objectively, a great movie.
Awards. Like, I watched Shutter Island recently on a flight that I was on. Like, I like watching movies that I think society would, and those are two like psychological thrillers and horror stories, if you want to call it Silence of the Lambs that. But I enjoy watching. Like, I went through the entire like Stanley Kubrick, like whatever that would be, this or filmography. Like, I watched 2001: A Space Odyssey on an airplane. Right. Like, I want to watch movies that are historically and culturally important.
Yeah.
That's that cool. I think a lot of people our age like may skip over.
I did hear try to avoid movies that shut your brain off. So if you're not able to, give me a movie that's more shut your brain off that you're into.
Legally Blonde.
I knew you were going to go there. That's the go-to answer. That's great stuff. And now a quick word about our friends at Good Walk Coffee. Mr. Simus, what's your coffee game been like recently?
Man, I always, and I mean always, have the Mudball Half Calf on me. I've been loving the Bump and Run cold brews on the go. And lately, it's been the breakfast ball.
Give me a little bit more color on the Bump and Run cold brew.
Well, I love making coffee at home, but I can't do it all the time. And when I really got to move and I need my good walk, I reach straight in the fridge, grab a can and go, and I get exactly what I need.
Where can the people go if they want to get involved with our friends at Good Walk Coffee?
You can purchase all your coffee, cold brew, espresso, pods, cases, beans, merch, and more for 20% off using code THETIE. That is THETIE at checkout. Set your custom subscription. The world is yours only at goodwalkcoffee.com.
Okay, with that, let's move on to a little bit of golf talk. Okay. Fourth Walker Cup this year, a lot of fun to watch on TV. You were strong. How is this pursuit different than some of the others? Just as life goes on, get a little bit older, more experience under your belt, more responsibilities. How did this prep and the pursuit of making the team look different than the ones in the past?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to answer that. Let's start with the obvious one being work. I have, at a glacial pace, I think I've begun to swing a handful of folks internally that, you know, there are positive merits to playing competitively, at least, you know, call it like a USGA or a Walker Cup level. You know, I've had the chance to meet a tremendous amount of people kind of through golf. And I think as an adult, the game has allowed the opportunity to maybe mature at a social level that I may not have otherwise been able to. I think you spend a lot of time by yourself, you know, in kind of this relentless, almost nebulous pursuit of, you know, trying to play and trying to play great in USGA events and, you know, to make team events. And I think, you know, as I look at my life, you know, both professionally and personally, there's a lot of things that I've given up, you know, relative to a lot of my peers, you know, friends getting married, maybe you haven't gone to those, or, you know, from a relationship standpoint, not being able to give it the same time, energy, and effort that you otherwise may have been able to had you not been pursuing something like that. From a work standpoint, like, you have a ton of friends that are giving up, you know, whether it's interest in a specific fund or certain responsibilities or leading teams at a more effective, you know, rate and capacity. So there's a lot of things where there's an example of the grass is always greener. And I think that the older you get, the more those voices and pressures seem to, you know, basically just become more important to you. So that's one side. Two, just physically, as you get older, your body begins to not do the things you want it to do quite as productively and efficiently as it did when you were in your early to mid 20s. And I'm sure you're just beginning to understand what this is like. Like, there are times when like you sleep improperly, or you're thinking about something and for some reason your neck just decides to hurt the next day.
All day today. My neck was killing me today. Yeah. And I did nothing different. I stretched everything. No day is different for me. And it just hurt.
So one observation just for the two of us, like, I think the best way to avoid this is to take care of your body when it doesn't hurt. It's almost preventative. And I think that one thing that really helps is just make a conscious effort from like a physical standpoint to work out, even if it's just body weight stuff, like just be active and walk and just be moving. And then, to answer your question, just the last one is there's just so many good players out there, right? I mean, you see the emergence of it every year. I mean, shoot, you just turned 25. Like, you're going up against a new crew of guys, you know, that either A, turn pro and then got their amateur status back that are total studs. Two, handful of young kids that didn't turn pro and maybe did 2 years of banking and then went into some, you know, type of a coverage type role, or, you know, maybe just pivoted out of that or whatever it may be. And, you know, they turn 25 and then they're there. Shoot, like, you could go to a Mormon mission and then get your, or not leave and leave your amateur status back. I mean, there's guys at the mid-am that have college bags, right? So that happens. Or, you know, the other alternative is, you know, folks, I would say like me and you, that I think maybe think it's really cool to fantasize the idea of turning pro, but genuinely just kind of love to compete. And part of what's great about the game is, you know, when you allow yourself some time to miss playing and practicing and competing, it almost makes you more productive and efficient when you do kind of go prepare and want to play in, you know, these bigger events. So I think a combination of all those different things, let alone the fact that it was at St. Andrews, you know, which is obviously kind of a grand cathedral and really core element of the game as we know it, all were things that weighed, but pretty special to be a part of it. Sorry for the long answer.
No, that was great stuff. I do want to talk about one other thing with the Walker Cup, but you mentioned in kind of the mid-amateur pursuit, there being guys who have turned pro and now have regained their amateur status. Anytime the mid-amateur comes up in podcast, people talking about it, that seems to be more and more a hot topic of conversation today. I'm probably more interested to get your opinion on this than anybody, as a guy who didn't turn pro and dusts up all of those guys anyway. So what do you think about guys getting their amateur status back and what that means for the mid-am game?
Well, that's high praise on your end, so thank you for that. You know, I think I've actually been on record about this for quite a long time, that I personally kind of think the mid should be 30 for various reasons. I just, at 25, you don't really know who you are. There's just a lot of different things. I mean, it obviously benefited me. So like, I know that's the most hypocritical thing you could possibly say. So I'll put my hand up there and forgive me on that front. But again, you know, I think, there's so many different ways to kind of look at that. Getting your amateur status back. I don't know. It's a tricky question, right? Because on one hand, you could sit there and, you know, kind of pound the pavement that, you know, it's too easy and you can go try it for a couple of years. And shoot, I played a guy in the mid 1 year that like won on the Corn Ferry Tour, which is wild. But at the same time, like, if you love the game and you want to get your amateur status back, like, you know, who am I to kind of say like, hey, you shouldn't be able to do that. So I don't know. It's a tricky one. And again, just kind of really talking this through, as I think you would agree, when we think about things that make, forget mid-amateur golf, just amateur golf in general, you know, so great, is of course, like, you know, competing and going up against guys that, you know, are studs and love the game. But more specifically, just there's so many great people, you know, and the relationships that are kind of created through the love of the game, which is something I kind of hearkened to earlier. So I don't know. It's such a non-answer, but at the same time, I don't know that there is a right answer here. And I think ultimately, you know, as long as you love to play and as long as you love to compete, I think there's always going to be a place for you, you know, in one capacity or the other. And ultimately, I think that's really kind of the takeaway here. So I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Honestly, I'm in a similar spot to you. I would probably just sit here and talk in a circle for, you know, 2 minutes on it anyway. I don't have a great answer. Just was curious to hear if you had any thoughts on it. But yeah, you just hear so much about it. And I don't know. I guess my one thought would be, anytime I do hear it, like, my sort of mental reaction is like, I don't know, like, what's the big deal? Like, that guy, I guess, wasn't good, didn't think he was good enough to make it at the pro level. And so if he ends up getting his amateur status back, like, there's a process that's laid out to do so. And at that point, he has the right to play in the events that he wants to play, and be it as it may, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you sit there, and if you play great and, you know, you have the result that you wanted, you have no problem with it. Yet if you play and you get beat, or, you know, you don't have the results you wanted, then you sit there and you are upset and bitch about it. So is the right answer either one of those? Probably not. Is the answer somewhere in the middle of those? Again, probably. To use the word again, it's a very kind of nebulous spot to be in. Every now and then, you know, I'll see something or someone sends something to me, you know, from Twitter or something, that has someone, you know, some keyboard warrior that's basically has some really hot take, or has some really, not dramatic, but, you know, some hard line that they're taking. And I don't know, who knows what the right answer is. It's a tricky spot, but I think we're kind of on the same page here.
Yeah, totally. So going back to the Walker Cup just briefly, I am curious to hear, like, where are you at with the Walker Cup, as you talk about, you know, potential kids, potential wife at some point, life circumstances, work, all of those things. It is, I mean, you've discussed it with me offline before. It's a process. Like, if you know you have a chance to make the team, everything that goes into that entire year, the 2 years leading up to it, like, you have to make a fairly conscious effort to do so. So I am really curious with what you've done this past summer, which we'll get into more, what you have coming up next year. I guess they're going to be two Walker Cups, not that far off. There's 25 and then 26, if I'm not mistaken. They're going to flip it back to even years. So where is your mind frame at right now with regard to future Walker Cups?
Great question. Don't have a good answer for you. I just spent 2 years from a golf standpoint with that event at the Home of Golf in the back of my mind. And basically from a practice and not practice standpoint, right? Like, I can't tell you how many times in December, January, February, early March, where you haven't touched a club in months and you're in the gym and you don't want to get through a workout, and you're like, no, but this will pay dividends 6 months down the line, right? So maybe that makes me weird or neurotic or whatever the right word is, but I'm trying to enjoy, you know, what's happened over the course of September. You win a heck of a lot less than you get beat in golf. And I think one thing, as I've gotten older, is, you know, when you're younger, when you're in your, you know, early 20s and you do something cool, you want to go have a bunch of cocktails and drinks with your friends. And as you get older, that kind of goes away. It's more like, no, I just really want to enjoy the heck out of what just happened. You still do it, just maybe in a slightly more responsible way. So I think right now where I'm at with it is I don't know. You know, I think it's really hard to do everything in your life that you want to do, given the pressures and constraints that go with that specific event. I was asked earlier this summer, you know, about, you know, winding down that pursuit, or, you know, is this going to be like my, you know, potentially like the last shot at that? And the answer that I gave was, I don't know, but I really want to try and make a conscious effort to maybe not have a big contingency of my year be governed specifically by what my WAGR ranking is, or, you know, what events I'm going to play in to go into that. You know, we had as I said, a pretty cool September and some amazing opportunities down the line. And, you know, a great opportunity to kind of test your game against the world's best players. So that'll be an amazing, you know, hopefully couple weeks. So we'll see. But let's just enjoy this one right now. Let's enjoy kind of where we're at. You know, let's enjoy so many the countless sacrifices that have gone into to kind of the journey of you know, having played on a fourth team and obviously having won a third mid. It's really hard. And I think the older you get, the more you realize how cool it is, which in a weird way almost makes it harder. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun, but if there's more to come, then great. If there's not, then that's cool too.
How do you go about enjoying yourself? That like really resonated when you said, oh, when you're in your early 20s, you want to go like have a bunch of drinks and go crazy, whatever, go out. Maybe it doesn't take the drinks out of the equation now, but like describe to me the setting after, like in all seriousness, after you win the mid-am, what do you do to kind of sit back and reflect on that event and kind of say like, hey, this is really cool and I'm going to do what I want to do to enjoy this?
I'm trying to think of like how the different years were unique from each other. The first one, right? Like it ended in late in the afternoon. You know, so you're going through media and signing stuff and, you know, you're having a couple beers, and I was driving back to the city that night. So a friend of mine was giving me a ride back from Pennsylvania, from Elberton, I think is where it is. And everything is just so new and so fresh, and like you turn your phone on, there's just so many text messages, and I'm one of those people that like I like to take the time to like get back to everyone and not just say hey thanks, and to basically be like write something like with thought. So you know, it probably took a couple weeks or whatever it was. And then for the second one and the third one, I guess, because you know, you had the first leg of it played Thursday afternoon and then the second leg played Friday morning, so you're kind of in this weird spot where it doesn't really like parlay really, really well into the night, so to speak. So like for this one, you know, with Sleepy, I was lucky enough to have a few buddies that were there kind of watching and supporting and following, and just had a couple beers and had lunch and just a lot of hugs, a lot of smiles, just reminiscing on, you know, kind of one-off moments that happened either throughout the day or maybe throughout the week. And it's just so cool to be with people that you love and care about, and you know, people that took time out of their busy schedules to come support you and like this just crazy endeavor that you set for yourself. I kind of think back and like immediately smile. Just, it goes back to the relationships and people you've had the chance to meet had it not been for golf. You know, it's pretty lucky.
Did you get anyone to text you, I guess, 21 or 23? Between the two rounds, like, you know, were you five up each of those times after the first 18 going into the next morning? Did you get any texts of like, hey man, I saw the results, congratulations, like so happy for you? Oh yeah, that hurts.
I got a couple emails and I'm sure I got a couple texts, but I don't remember which one there was. But when that happens, like I'm very like, I want to have like no text messages. The only one I have is voicemails that have just like compiled over the years, because you want to like hold on to cool ones, you know, like from whether it could be like, you know, just a family event or whatever, but just, you get the point. But like, I want no emails. I want no texts. Like, I don't like notifications. I'm not one of those people. So the chunks that are easier, right? Because you check your email, just like, you know, stuff going on to make sure that you're not missing something really important. But there was one email I got, and I forget who it was from. Even if I did remember, I wouldn't say it just to leave them out of it. But I got one email that was like, congratulations. I like just couldn't help myself. Like my OCD kicked in and I was like, it's not over yet. Like we got to keep pushing. Like we haven't done anything. So like, I was like, Evan's a great player. Like you can go out there and shoot 10 or whatever it was. And, but that was the only one. And I'm sure after I sent it, I was kind of like, Stu, you need to calm down. This is an honest mistake.
No, I would struggle with that. If I were ever in that sort of position, I would be like, oh my gosh, how do I respond to this? Yeah, that's funny. So yeah, with the mid-am, like that, it's the Super Bowl for someone who's in their 20s, 30s as an amateur golfer. You've played seven of them, if I'm not mistaken. There was no event in 2020. You've won three, round of 16, round of 64, and then two semifinal runs, if I'm remembering that correctly.
That's correct. Yeah.
So five out of seven, you've won either four or six matches. Mentally speaking, what is it about your prep and approach to the event that you think has allowed you to show up every single year? Because it's not easy. It's really not that easy to make it nearly to the end of the thing more times than not.
Well, that's nice of you to say. So thank you. I think we can start with the fact that everyone's really good, right? Like, everyone is capable of going out and shooting 4, 5, 6, 7 under, bogey free, and just hitting a buzzsaw. So with that context, and I've used this example a couple times, I kind of got caught in 2019 in the USAM when I played this young kid, good junior, hits it nowhere. I was clipping him by like 40 or 50 off the tee. Pinehurst number 2, long course, super tough around the greens. I'm hitting in like 8 iron. He's hitting in like 5 iron. And I just got my ass beat, right? Not to swear, but like I just got smoked. And it was a short game clinic and a course management clinic. And he did not care about my resume. He wasn't intimidating, or if he was, he didn't show it. Like, it was just I was so impressed. And it wasn't really impressed until after. And that kid has turned out to be a pretty good player. His name's Maxwell Moldovan. So it was just, I think it was for me a good reset of, hey, it doesn't matter if you haven't heard of them. It doesn't matter where they came from. It doesn't matter if they're a junior, mid, senior, whatever it is. If you don't bring it from not just the first hole, but like the night before, the morning of, warming up, like everyone's really good. So I'll say that. And then the other thing I'll say is, and I'll use a different example in this context, but I played a guy in the quarters of my first USAM named Michael McDermott, who's since become a good friend. And he's from Philly, and we played at Stonewall in Pennsylvania. And when I played Mike, I felt like I was playing like the whole city of Philly, right? And everyone that follows sports knows, like, Philly fans, they ride hard for their boys and their girls, but they ride hard for their locals. And I lost the first 3 holes. I think he went birdie, birdie, birdie. And I was able to kind of chip away at it. And I think I ended up clipping him on 18. But the point of that is, when you're 3 down, especially at that stage in the game, you know, you obviously can, you know, your nerve, everything starts to get a little bit faster. You know, you start to feel like you have to like push in certain ways. You feel like, you know, you're kind of up against the wall. And I think where I'm going with this is basically, I've been fortunate enough to have played a bunch where those situations of seeing various situations where, like, there's just not that many you haven't seen, right? Like, I know what it's like to be 2 or 3 down and have to birdie the last handful of holes. Or I know what it's like to feel like you don't have your best stuff and, you know, to just try and stay in the mix. Or, you know, as you apply it, you know, to stroke play events, like, I know what it's like to hit balls on the range with guys you've idolized for your entire life, right? So there's not that many situations or moments that maybe you haven't seen before. And I think, to go back to your original question, I think that allows you to prepare in a way where a lot of the noise is maybe taken away, and you know what it's like going into an event to kind of understand how your body feels, what you need to do to play well, but at the same time, you know, maybe not necessarily feel like you have to be Superman on any given day. Again, we're starting with everyone's really good. I have a lot of respect for everyone that plays in those. You can't just fake your way into match play the USGA event.
Well, I want to kind of like spin this now the other way and use that as a parlay into the US Open and just majors at large. So, like, when you just calling it the way it is, like, when you show up at a mid-am, everyone kind of knows who you are, right? Like, especially at this point. When you show up at a US Open, that doesn't necessarily change, but where you sit in that field is very different. So
yeah, I agree.
How how does that change things? What is your mentality like when you show up at a US Open or a Masters in terms of what you're trying to get out of that week, being that you're not the person that everyone's like, oh God, like there's Hagestad. It's more of, hey, that's really awesome that you're here. Best of luck this week, man. Like, what does that do to you mentally?
You nailed it. I mean, that's an amazing, amazing question. And you're absolutely right, right? Like when you played a practice round with a good friend this week and he made a comment on whatever hole it was. And, you know, he was kind of like, you know, all the roughs up and fairways are tight. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, there's no rough, right? Like, cause you've just played like the Western or the USAM, or if you miss the fairway, like you're taking lob wedge and chipping it out.
It's funny. Right? That was my reaction at Sleepy as well. Everyone was talking about the rough. I was like, I was comparing it to Cherry. I was like, there's no rough. This is fine.
Yeah. And I didn't mean it necessarily in like a disparaging or a demeaning way, but to your point that you just alluded to, like you've just come from the USAM. So you're showing up to the mid and you're like, yeah, we're gonna be fine. Right. So it allows you to maybe play your game with a little bit less noise, with less distraction. And I wouldn't say with less fear, but with more in the context of you're willing to miss and hit poor shots. And when that happens, it frees you up a little bit. And I think, to go back to your question, you know, about the majors, is that's maybe something that I have struggled with in the past. I mean, again, like you're on the range with people that you've grown up with, looking up to your entire life, right? Like I've been on the putting green, hit balls next to Tiger. It's really scary. Scary is not the right word, but it's intimidating, right? Cause you feel out of place and it's uncomfortable. Or like, I've been fortunate to play a couple practice rounds with Adam Scott. And like the first time I've told the story a couple times, but the first time we played together was back nine of Augusta. And, you know, it was like a Tuesday practice round. And I'm sure I was just peppering him with questions of like, you know, for this pin, what do you think about here? And do you miss here and this and that? And I'm finally like, I don't know if he was fed up with me or if he just was just being a good, you know, kind of like older liaison in the moment. And he was really great. We've actually laughed about it since, but he was basically just like, hey, like, so you won the mid to get into this. I was like, yeah. He goes, and you probably had a lot of great shots to get here. And I said, yeah. And he goes, and there's probably a handful of spots where you hit great shots and there was just nowhere to miss. Cause if you do, you got to just go figure it out from there. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, well, that's kind of how it is here. Right. Like if the pin's back right on 16 and you go long in the bunker, you know, you shouldn't go there, but you've hit it in spots where you just can't be before. Conversely, like if you hit it, you know, down left, like you're going to have a 40 footer that's probably going to break 8 feet. Like just go play hard. Right. So again, when it applies to the majors, there definitely needs to be a little bit more of this feeling of, hey, let's go play our game. Let's go play great. And if you don't, like your life's not going to change that much. It'd be really cool if you did, but you know, you earned your way here. Let's go have a great week. And I think that, you know, in other USGA events, maybe it's a little bit easier to kind of go in with that mentality. And I think just because of everything that happens at major championships, there's almost this, you know, sense of, or exponential created sense of, you have to play well, I guess. This is a tricky question to put into words in a succinct form, because you're right. And you've, in the question you're asking, you've nailed.
Well, and it's fascinating to hear Adam Scott put it that way of like, hey, look, you're going to approach shots that it's just like you execute or you don't. I actually, when I think about when I first played in US amateurs and the first time that golf is like actually kind of hard.
Played in six or seven?
Six, yeah. But I'm talking about like first time that I played in them, I think about like you show up and you're like, oh my God, this is a hard golf course. Like, what am I going to do? And I actually found there to be like such a freeing nature to being like, hey, look, the fairway out there, it's about 25 yards wide. So we kind of have two options here. I stripe it or I don't. If I miss by 12 yards, I miss the fairway. If I miss by 112 yards, I miss the fairway. Golf can become very binary at a high level. And so, you know, I'd have to think that a major, the way that Adam Scott put it, I would think he knows, just is more of that where, yeah, you might see that on pretty much every swing. But at the end of the day, I find that to be actually quite freeing where you're just like, I'm going to swing it at the flag. I'm going to try to make a smart swing here. And if I don't pull it off, it's probably not going to turn out great regardless. And no one's going to shoot me in all likelihood if the ball doesn't end up where I want it to.
So one other comment is, I think if you were to take away the crowds and take away a lot of the infrastructure and the scoreboards and whatever else, you know, structurally and kind of ancillarily there is outside of just the golf, I think, you know, if you were to like go play a mid-am event there, or even an amateur event, you know, at, you know, say Augusta National or, you know, this year, you know, the US Open's at Pinehurst number two, but you look at what Sam Bennett did last year. And I think that there would be, if it wasn't called, we'll say the US Open, right? I think that there'd be a lot more amateurs that would go out there and really kind of play great. And I think that because it's called the US Open, you know, and there's 30,000 people that are there, you know, there's certainly, maybe you're a little bit tighter. It's a little more restricting. Maybe you don't sleep quite as well the night before. You're not as much in your routine. And when you throw all those things in the mix as well, like, I mean, I can tell you firsthand, like the one thing you can't really prep for is, you know, when there are 25,000 people that are on property, right? Like you can't just go hit balls and practice and have that type of experience. Like you need, I remember like at the Open, at the Country Club, like I want to say it was like on Tuesday, it was almost like a switch that flipped. And I almost had this like wave of like, hey, like if you hit a bad one, who cares? Literally, who cares? Like it's going to happen. So let's just do our thing. Right. And it almost kind of like freed me up a little versus like maybe being a little bit more guidey. And you look at the Walker Cup this year, like at St. Andrews, like having 8,000-10,000 people around, whatever it was, like there's nowhere to hide, right? Like it's very exposing, like it's very uncomfortable at first. And after you kind of like get past that initial shock or uncomfortable feeling, then you can start kind of doing what you do, like what you're comfortable with, like whatever your game is. And I think the quicker that you can become comfortable in that atmosphere and that environment, like the sooner you can get back to like what got you there in the first place. And that's, you know, playing your game and not really caring what people think or whatever.
When it comes to playing in front of crowds, as someone that has done it a lot, but then also, you know, you still do get to play some golf here and there where you're not necessarily playing in front of crowds. What do the crowds mean to you? Do you try to just purely tune it out, or do you view it as like, hey, there's potentially more benefit here. If I make a putt, it can be a little bit more exciting. Like, how do you think about playing in front of crowds?
I don't have a good answer for that because I'm not someone that can like go back and forth with interacting with the crowd. And, you know, I mean, you do kind of one of these or, you know, a thumbs up or, you know, whatever, but some guys are amazing with it, you know, interacting and, you know, kind of just the,
waving their hats around in circles.
Yeah. There's all that sort of stuff. You saw it at the Ryder Cup, right? Like I'm one of those people that I've always felt like I do a little bit better when it's kind of like head down, let's go to work. You know, if there's a time to acknowledge, then yeah, like of course do that. But I think as I've gotten older, I'm not as demonstrative as maybe I wanted to be as like a 13 or 14 year old, you know, as we watch Tiger like fist bumping left, right, and center. It's not because you don't want it any less or anything like that. It's more just, I think, there's just a lot of energy that goes into it. And, you know, there's certainly times where like big putts merit, you know, having big fist bumps and all that. But I think certainly in the last few years, it's gotten a little bit more tame. But yeah, I mean, if you don't practice or if you're not in that environment all the time, it's just a little different. It's a little bit of a shock to the senses. The other thing I would say is like, if I were to go do it right now, you know, 3 weeks removed from the Walker Cup, you know, two from the mid or whatever, I'd probably be a lot more comfortable with it than maybe in April when, you know, you haven't played in something like that in however long.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. So you've played two Walker Cups in the States, two Walker Cups overseas. Ryder Cup just wrapped up yesterday. Everyone is just throwing out all of their opinions on what's going on with the US team versus Europe. And I mean, at the end of the day, it's like people who are away just get washed every single time. What's your take on playing at an international Walker Cup or Ryder Cup? Essentially, how would you articulate kind of what we're seeing with the Ryder Cup right now and kind of leveraging your experiences of playing in front of home and away crowds?
Yeah, home and away crowds are a real thing. They're a very real thing. Having momentum and having people supporting you on your side. I'm not really here for like the catcalling and making and turning it into, you know, a straight up like NFL game where there's like personal attacks. Like, that's not cool. I think that, you know, the game itself fosters a lot of really, really neat characteristics and, you know, just kind of elegance and, you know, just manners in general, just really great, beneficial kind of characteristic traits. Like, you probably just generally, like, not forget golf, like, you probably shouldn't do or conduct yourself in a sense that your mom would be disappointed in. So, like, with that context, like, the event itself, you know, you have the opportunity to play for your country. You have the opportunity to be a part of a team, you know, that is, it's an honor and a privilege to be a part of that. And I've never been on a Ryder Cup team, so I can't speak to that. But I think if you were to ask any one of those guys, you know, going over there, like, crowd, that environment's it's a real thing. And, you know, teeing it up for your country is about as cool as it gets. I think that, and again, what do I know? I think that maybe following kind of Andy Johnson and Brendan Porath's, you know, thoughts on their respective pods, that we could maybe lean in a little bit more to the analytics. Maybe they did this year. I have no idea. I think if you don't have analytics available and you know someone else's game and your personalities mesh, then maybe playing with close friends or someone's game, you know, makes a lot of sense. But if you have the analytics, which I think is something that's been documented that Europe really kind of leaned into this year, like, it showed, right? I mean, they're good too. The other side of the coin is just play better,
right? That usually solves most things.
They're good too. Yeah.
But foursomes. It's really been the only thing that's given you much trouble in the Walker Cup. Clearly it gives the Americans absolute fits, whether it's the Walker Cup or the Ryder Cup. What makes foursomes really hard for the Americans versus the Europeans or GB and I?
Yeah, I think it's just a rhythm thing. I think I'm very comfortable with the way that I play, and maybe I'm a little bit stubborn and could do a better job of, you know, kind of switching that into, you know, doing what works for your partner. And then the other side is, you know, like, I played with Mal in the first round back at Seminole in 21. And if you looked at our card versus every other group that's only played, we'd have beaten them. Right. So it goes back to just play better. Right. So that's one alternative and a very important one. And then two, if you get guys that whose games are maybe either slightly more complementary or in foursomes, it's really important to have guys with the most elite short games. Best case scenario, everyone stripes, but if they don't, you know, then they leave it in spots where they can keep themselves in it, with the exception of that 9 and 7 that happened this weekend. Like, I feel like there's not a lot of like 3 and 2s or 2 and 1s or 4 and 2s. I feel like there's a lot of like beatdowns or a lot of 1-up, 2-ups. Right. So I could also be totally wrong, and that's just one person's thought. Like, thinking back to a lot of the foursomes matches that I've had, you know, it's just great. I don't know. It's great to have guys that roll the lights out of it between 3 and 12 feet. And I don't have a good answer for this. Analytics and play better. There you go.
Cool. So let's move back towards some of what you have coming up. U.S. Open, Masters. What are your thoughts on Pinehurst? I know you played the 2008 U.S. Amateur there. You mentioned 2019 earlier. Clearly, you know the golf course. You've played in multiple U.S. Opens. How do you think this one sets up for you versus some of the other ones you've played? And what kind of expectations look like at this point? I mean, this is your fifth one. You've made the cut. You made the cut last year at the Country Club. what do your expectations look like? And then how do you feel about Pinehurst and the platform that course will give you to be successful?
Have you played Pinehurst in USAM? Did you ever play like North South or any of those?
I played 2019 and then 2019. North South as well. So yeah, I mean, I'm from Charlotte. I've played Pinehurst 30 times.
Got it. So hard golf course, really hard.
Yes.
Right?
Tough. Really, really, really tough.
Really, really tough.
There's a sound bit.
Yeah, really tough. Great reference. I think there's a reason that Oakmont, Wingfoot, and Pinehurst are always the kind of de facto backup option for the U.S. Open, because it just doesn't take it that long for it to get in a spot where they could host a U.S. Open. Kind of like what we were just saying, right? I'm going to sound like a broken record, like back to that comment about Adam, like you kind of have to hit good shots. And if you don't, then you just got to go deal with it, right? Like you don't want to miss it in certain spots, but at the same time, if you go the other direction and you miss it in the spot where you're not supposed to miss it, then still probably not a really great spot. So, I mean, that's just what a great test that is. It identifies really quickly kind of, you know, what you do well, what you don't do well. I'm excited to go play it, you know, in that environment and in that context. And, you know, I'm going to Texas wedge it from everywhere. I'm excited to go test my game against the world's best, you know, on a stage like that, you know, that is a tried and true U.S. Open setup that the USGA knows really well. That's obviously kind of where their new headquarters is down there. There's gonna be great kind of fans and fan engagement that's there. You know, when you think of kind of like the cathedrals of American golf, I think all of us agree that Pinehurst is in that category. You know, crazy great golf IQ there, a golf course that is just got a tremendous amount of history with it. I'm excited. I think it'll be a great week.
How do you compare and contrast the both physical and mental prep that goes into a US Open versus the Masters? Because as I sit here and think about it, and I know nothing, but if I did know something, I would think that the US Open, there's a little bit more of like, this is a golf tournament. Like I'm going to play. Yes, it's a major, but it's going to be on a really hard course. Whereas the Masters, there's more that goes into that whole week with being there as an amateur and the crow's nest and some of the events and the dinners that come with it and having all of the members there and just the excitement that comes with the Masters. So I'm curious as to now this being your third Masters and fifth US Open, how you think about those two events differently, even though once the gun goes off, you know, you're playing a major against the world's best.
You and I are very alike with pretty much everything you've said this entire podcast. So you're right across the board. I don't think it's an overstep or rude to maybe say that as an American, you know, playing golf at any competitive level, while we have all the respect in the world for the US Open and it is our national championship, I think there's a large contingency of people that maybe do put Augusta National kind of on a pedestal, and specifically, or more specifically, the Masters. You know, when December and January and February kind of roll around and you start to hear that, you know, the piano and you start to see the commercials, it's a tradition like any other. It's a living museum. And in a lot of parts of the country that are a little bit colder, right around the second weekend of April, you start to get the itch that you want to go play and practice and kind of get back into golf. And, you know, spring is right around the corner. And it's just, it's a really special time of year for those that like to play and compete. So with that context, all the different, you know, traditions and parts of the Masters is really, I mean, I cried when I got both the first and the second invitations in the mail. My birthday is April 10th, so it's always kind of around that time. And it's just, there's a bunch of like family stories that we have where basically, like, I guess I was like a 4 or 5 year old that like ran away from my mom to go watch the Masters with my dad. Like, I mean, just little stuff like that. And when I think of the US Open, I think of a really big US AM. So I'm not in any way putting down, you know, one or building up the other. They're just two very different events. They're both very challenging tests. I think they're different tests in the sense that the US Open is maybe more of an all-encompassing test of your game and, you know, kind of exposing weaknesses while also, you know, allowing you to try and lean into your strengths, versus the Masters is almost more of a test of the expectations that you put on yourself and the internal pressures that you put on yourself to try and go perform at a place that you've kind of fantasized about for your entire life. So both are great. Both have unique characteristics that are very specific to them. And both are tournaments that you dream of not just playing in, but playing great in, and, you know, hope and prepare for the opportunity to try and put yourself in that situation. And I've been fortunate enough to have played in a handful of those before. And, you know, I'm truly honored and looking forward to the opportunity to go. And as I've said a couple times, you know, go try and be me and play my best golf. And with the knowledge that, hey, if you don't, it's okay. It's still pretty darn cool.
So was 2017 your first US Open as well?
Yeah.
Okay. And you qualified for that one. That was not a mid-amateur exemption. Wow. That's impressive. I think it was that year because Partiali won 2017 and he was exempt for Shinnecock.
So I won the mid in the first time, the last mm-hmm. year that you were not exempt.
That you weren't exempt. Right. So 7 years removed from playing those two events for the first time. You know, as we've discussed multiple times today, so I was looking at your Wagger thing back, you know, going through the years, you played a bunch of events in 2017. So you were like very well practiced, super prepared seemingly to go play in those things. I'm guessing 2024 will look a little bit different in certain ways. You're probably not going to play 15 events leading up to those couple majors, but
how many did I play in 17? Do you remember? Cause
I didn't count it up, but I saw maybe even like a South African amateur and some
South American. Yeah, I got
South American. Okay.
With Julia Potter, Megan Stassi, and Scott Harvey. That was a great week. That was cool. Like the second week of January. I usually, not to cut you off, but I usually average, if you get invited to play like in a Walker Cup or a major, like you're obviously playing, right? So let's not sugarcoat that. And then obviously if you qualify for USGA event, also pretty cool. But I think my average for however many years was like a low of 7 and at the most 9. Like it's been a pretty tight, predictable schedule. So to answer your question, I'll hopefully make, you know, if I'm invited, hopefully make a couple trips and get to go see it and hopefully spend some time down there. And then I'll probably play the Azalea to get ready for it. Maybe throw in, I looked at, you know, not to get ahead of myself, but I kind of looked at that. I think timing wise, that makes sense. You need tournament reps, right? You just do. And to go in to play your best, you're going to be a little bit sharper and a little bit just better, you know, from a tournament standpoint, kind of towards the end of playing in a whole bunch in August than you would in March. It's not a hot take. Like, I mean, you can go back through the years. I mean, Sigel's been on podcast saying that, Vinny's been on podcast saying that. Like, you need tournament reps. So I'll probably play the Azalea. I'll probably play a mini tour event or something, you know, just to get any kind of tournament experience. It doesn't matter if it's a 6,200 yard course, you just need reps. For the US Open, you know, I won't play the four ball, so that one will be a little trickier. I don't know. Maybe play the Anderson if you're ready for it. Like I did in 2020.
Pretty solid.
Yeah. No, I probably won't do that. Two back-to-back 36 whole days isn't the best way to get ready for a US Open. We'll see. I don't know. I'll let's let's circle back to that.
Where do you think things are with your game going into 2024 versus 2017? Do you think that you, with the experience under your belt, just nuts and bolts, like, hey, I'm better, I'm worse, I'm where I'm at with each individual part of your game, do you think you're better off or worse suited to go play really well in the Masters and US Open versus when you first started doing it?
Well, I'm certainly better off mentally, right? I think just from the standpoint of, and I said it a little bit ago, not necessarily in an arrogant or an ignorant way, but, you know, I think that if you play well or you don't, you know, with the exception of winning, so let's caveat that, it probably isn't going to affect your life that much, right? Like, of course you want to play well. And you're going to do everything you can to give yourself the opportunity to play well. But I think going into the Masters in 2017, like, there's this tremendous sense of self-worth and what if, and just there's so much of the unknown of how are you going to react physically, mentally, emotionally. Like, I was in the room because there was a big storm that came through. I was in, they canceled the par three contest. I was in my room and I like couldn't talk to anyone. Like, I was terrified, you know, rolling out, and just, I just didn't have like the emotional capacity to basically like be social at the house we were staying in. Like, I was incredibly uncomfortable, is not the right word, but I was very emotionally raw and insecure with maybe just, I wouldn't say my game, but like the potential outcomes of that week. And when I think of that week, you know, it's far from the best I've ever played, but given the circumstances, it's by far the best I've ever scored, you know, just with kind of everything going on. And I think the uncertainty of just who I was as a person, you know, as a player, it's just a very raw experience. And I think I grew a lot that week more than anything from the standpoint of like a self-belief, perspective. So when you compare, you know, and I say this now in the fall, right, versus in the spring when you haven't played as much and you're probably not quite as sharp as you would be right now. And I think as you look, you know, going into next year, you're certainly more comfortable with a lot of those aspects of it. Like, it's okay to hit bad shots. It's going to happen. Right. Just is. You're probably going to make some really, really dumb decisions or uncommitted golf swings. And of course you do your best, like, to not avoid that, but, you know, to basically try and hit it where you're looking. But like, if you don't, that's okay. You've hit bad shots before. You'll do it again. So I think from the standpoint of that, like, I made a triple on 11 in 2022. And I think I made triple on 12 too. Maybe I made double. I don't know. I made a whole bunch. Like, I hit all the shots, all of them. Dumped one in Race Creek. Super embarrassing. Hit one OB on 11 after I was playing okay. Like, life goes on, right? So, by the way, like, those are two really hard holes. And they have been for the better part of 80 years. So, that's okay. And I say this, you know, obviously to you as a friend and as also like a confidant, but I think, you know, mentally, like, you do everything you can to play well and to prepare. But I think as I've gotten older, there's been maybe a little bit more of that willingness to play your best and, you know, just kind of see what happens.
Yeah, no, that's a great message. So last question I want to ask you today, this is like kind of a complete 180, but I think you'll appreciate this question. Talking a lot about your game today, someone that I know has had a big effect on your game, also talking a lot about USGA golf today, road to 100. Chris Zambry recently announced as the head of the USGA development team, which I'm a huge Zambry fan. I mean, go card rather than fight on, as I said earlier. But I think Zambry is an awesome guy and like a perfect pick for that. I'm curious, A, if you had any involvement with that, and B, just kind of what your thoughts are on the development program overall, but also with Zambry leading the ship.
Well, I feel the same way about Chris, and I credit him tremendously. for so much of the success that I've been lucky enough to kind of, you know, have, because I just think from a practice standpoint and a principles standpoint, when you are practicing and just the discipline, you know, to keep really borderline unrealistically high standards when you're practicing. Oh my gosh, I think the world of Chris Ambry, and I'm sure you saw the smile on my face. I couldn't be happier for him. Did I have any involvement? I'm going to say the answer is no. I sent in an encouraging text, but that's all I had. In fact, that probably only hurt his chances versus helping them. No, Chris is, I could not be happier for him. It's the perfect role. One thing that coach really loves to do and is really good at, and it's tough to tell, you know, an 18 to 20 year old kid this, as I was one of those 18 to 20 or 22 year old kids. If you just shut your mouth and allow him to help you, he will make you a better player. And I just think the world of him, going out of his way to do everything in his power. And I can go back to stories about USC that I just won't do in the interest of time, but he will do anything for his guys that are willing, to basically lean into his program, to getting better and to kind of doing everything in their power to get to whatever the next level may be. I have a lot of time for Chris Ambry, and I thank the world of coach, and I sincerely could not be happier for him.
Good stuff. All right, Stu, I appreciate you taking some time on a Monday night. Couple working stiffs here. Probably got to go hammer the keyboards a little bit more. It's late, but it's not too late. So appreciate you hopping on. Always fun to catch up, and best of luck with everything coming up.
Thanks, man. Always good to talk to you.